So when we're talking about flow, I remember when I started to wonder about this experience, and it was through the experience of working with a group of people, facilitating a meeting, and my experience of flow was knowing what to say at the right time, knowing what the group needed, and knowing how to bring the group together in that moment. And I wanted to investigate essentially this feeling of like happiness for me. What was this like loss of sense of time? What was this experience of like the zone? And I hear developers talk about this a lot as like heads down time. It felt important to me because I wondered, what were the qualities of this experience of flow that could be replicated on other teams, and how are leaders cultivating flow on other teams? Flow, I feel like, can have a very mystical vibe, and I want to dispel that. The research on flow is essentially synonymous with peak performance. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about the two are very intertwined. They're one cannot exist without the other. So why it's important is that if we're creating an environment that is conducive to flow, we're essentially saying we're creating an environment for our teams to perform at their best.
I'm Sarah Rose Belloc.
I'm John Ragazine. Welcome to Two Scrums Up. We're two Scrum Masters and builders of Agile teams across the world.
Together, we talk about cultivating psychological safety first and equity-minded remote Scrum teams.
Yeah, when I think about it, and it's funny that you said the mysticism angle, because I had this thought over the weekend, actually, about how I could sit and do work I'm really engrossed in for like 3 or 4 hours at a stretch. You know, you'll hear it a lot where people are like, I forgot to eat lunch because I was in the zone and working. But conversely, where I am in my life, I couldn't meditate for 4 hours straight. So over the weekend, we wanted to introduce meditation to our four-year-old, my son Peter. So sometimes with kids, you have to not bend the truth, but create urgency where there is none, right? And so I said to him, hey, we're going to do meditation. I don't want to do meditation. Oh, but my doctor said it's really good for me if I do meditation, and I want to do it with you because I'm nervous. And so can we do it together? Because the doctor said. I was like, well, if the doctor said, I mean, you know, like, so that's how I got him on board. Anyway, the point of the matter is we did 10 minutes and it was he did better than I did overall with being still and being calm and being there. And so when I think about when people equate flow to meditation experience or whatever, I think it's very different because it's actively engaging in something, not purposely disconnecting yourself from what's going on so that you can bring yourself down.
Well, I mean, I would say that experience of the transcendence is the experience of like being in this transcendent state of being. But the reality is that experience can be experienced doing so many different things. It can be experienced playing music. It can be experienced during meditation, sure. It can be experienced writing code. It can be experienced writing an essay or an article or facilitating a meeting or playing a sport. Like, I think that, and this is not just Sarah Rose's theory of the experience of flow. This is based on decades of research, whereas like it's the beauty of this experience of flow is that it's experienced across professions, doctors. What the experience is that of performing at your best. And that could be anything. But I agree. I also first learned about it in kind of this dogmatic, with like very dogmatic language that was associated with like kind of mysticism or like right. A more spiritual angle. And so, but what I learned and what was really surprising to me was actually this is very practical, and actually it's something that we can experience on teams, especially in Scrum, which is designed to create this like ideal cross-functional, high-performing dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about this a lot too when we start talking about this in a more tangible, more accessible way. I still remember maybe like 10 years ago, I was involved in an ultimate frisbee league, and I remember sometime it was a very tough game. We used to play at nighttime, so the lights were out on the field and all these things were happening. But I remember seeing one of my teammates had somehow run well beyond the person covering them. And the only way I could throw to them was to do a hammer throw. Do you know, Sarah Rose, what a hammer throw is? Yeah, no, it's so dorky. So a hammer throw is an over your head throw where you throw the frisbee and it kind of, it's also called a cutter. Yes. And yes, we're both miming the right thing that no one can see. And it comes in sort of like upside down and it comes in hard. But I knew that Mike, the guy I was throwing to, could handle it. But I was being covered by this very aggressive player and I couldn't do like a clean natural throw. So I kind of threw it almost like from behind my head. And all I knew was Mike was going to catch this. And it was like almost vertical and it just came shooting down and like hit him right in the chest and he fell down in the end zone and we scored a point. But
what did you feel like in that moment?
Well, it's great. I still remember it. Like, you know, a decade out, you know, I don't remember Mike's last name, but I remember that throw. I can still see it. And the person's reaction of like, oh, come on, who was covering me? I remember they were so disappointed. And the reason why is because like there was no graceful calculations or plan to that. It was pure instinct in the moment. And my body and my brain just knew what to do. I have no idea how I exactly did it, but everything just kind of took over and it was, in a way, effortless. It was something I could never do if I tried. But because I wasn't trying, I was just doing, it happened. And I still remember it to this very day.
John, I love your story because it ties in perfectly with the 9 dimensions of flow. So the 9 dimensions of flow come out of the original research by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And the 9 dimensions of flow are the following. These are basically like identifiers of flow. They don't all have to be present at the same time. But if you're thinking about, have I experienced some of these identifiers of flow in my own life, or like the story you just shared, here's what you might have come across. So the 9 dimensions are a balance of high skill and high challenge, clear goals, unambiguous feedback, concentration, the merging of action and awareness. So that experience that you described, John, of like you knew how to act and you were aware of what was happening on the field, what was happening with the frisbee, that kind of merging of one together, a sense of control over the situation and self, an autotelic experience, or that kind of addictive feeling of this high during flow where you want to re-experience this feeling after it happens, and a loss of self-consciousness. And then lastly, the transformation of time. The transformation of time, so losing awareness of time passing. Do some of these ring a bell? Do you feel like some of these are familiar?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, you could even sort of picture it a little bit in the example that I have of like, as I remember it, I remember things being slower, or like, I wasn't seeing everything. Like I couldn't tell you who else was on the field doing what, but I do know that I had that one vision of Mike running and I was like focused on that. And my body knew that I had to make the frisbee go from here to there at this speed, at that rate. And again, like I said, I don't know how I exactly did it. If I tried to do it again, even with like no pressure of the game and no pressure of being covered, I would never be able to do it. But it happened because of the environment.
Right. So these experiences can be experienced individually or collectively. And so when you think about it, you could think about it in terms of sports, or you could think about it in other contexts, specifically on a team. So it could be with anything that you're doing on your team, with any type of task.
what you helped me understand is that the flow we're talking about is not something that you turn on or off. It's what can you put into the environment to have that flow hopefully occur, hopefully happen. And what's going to get in the way of that are all of these internal dialogues of I'm being underutilized. I have too much skill for this task. I'm being entrusted with something that I don't think I can accomplish. I have anxiety because this is so hard. I've never done this before.
And it could be even like, I've never done this before. I can't do this. Like, I don't have the space to speak up on this team.
Exactly right. Like what can we put into place that will circumvent or help ameliorate these blockers to flow?
Yes.
Like you said, feeling like I'm in a safe environment. I can bring this up to the team and they will help me and they won't judge me as being lesser than.
Yeah.
You know, I know that if I put this out there and there's all these problems with my code solution, the feedback I'll get back is going to be given in a way that's not blamey, that does let me build on to the future rather than just cut me down and knock me out. Like, it's crazy to me to think about the end game of flow as like the perpetual potential, right? This can always be happening, but all the stuff that we do as people to ourselves and to others around us
get in the way,
intentionally or unintentionally. Yeah, exactly. Just like cuts it off, you know? And it's like the constant danger that you have to be thinking about. And so like thinking about it as this thing that's always there and just thinking about how can we ourselves and we as like people on a team support everyone to get as close to that or into it as possible.
Yeah.
It's really, like I said, like flipped the whole idea of it for me. And it's helped me think differently about how I will be engaging with my team, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
And I want to say that there's a difference between working on something for the weekend and working for hours and getting nothing done. And you don't know where the time went, but you've gotten nothing done versus you lose a sense of time and you're performing at your best. I think that there is a distinction there too.
Oh, yeah.
So just because you work for a long time on something, it doesn't mean that it's actually good.
It's right. Like, yeah. The fear of the blank page or the fear of all those things is real.
Right. So, like, you spend hours writing something and it's total crap. So that's why that's the key there is like that high skill, high challenge versus like you're sitting there for hours and, you know, you're writing something that's really boring, but you know that your skills are higher than whatever you're working on. And then you're unsatisfied. Like there's a difference. There's a difference there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So do you feel like we've covered enough of like why it's important or like why is it important on Scrum teams specifically?
Well, that's what I want to get to is that I want to get to the point of how can anyone on the team unlock this potential benefit for themselves and for everyone else.
So John, I'm very excited for our guest today. Charis Alexander is one of my close friends and a brilliant human, and I am excited for her to speak specifically and talk to us and be in discussion with us about the topic of flow state, a topic that's very close to my heart. It's been part of my research for the last few years and cultivating that experience of individual flow and team flow. So Charis, welcome to Two Scrums Up.
Thank you, Sarah Rose. So glad to be here. Thank you, John, for having me as well. My name is Charis Alexander. I am the founder of a company called Laid. It's a headwear company with hats with removable and washable silk linings. But I'm also a multidisciplinary design consultant, and I do brand strategy consulting for a variety of different companies, from fashion to tech to companies in the education space and nonprofits most recently. So it's a pleasure to be here. Flow is also very, very, very much so important to the work that I do and glad to be here to talk about it.
When did you first start identifying this as a benefit to you and your work? I would love to hear more about that.
For me, when I think about flow and when I started to be really conscious of it, I would say as a creator and somebody who designs and makes art, but also interacts with a variety of different people from, you know, whether that's manufacturers or people more in charge of the business operations, people who I need to help me with different, you know, tasks and throughout my projects, it's really important for me to think about how I relate to those different people and how open I am to their processes. So I guess in becoming conscious of the creation process and all the different elements that are involved with creating something, whether it's a physical product or a digital product, just being open to the transition between the different roles and the tasks there in between. So I guess that's the most conscious way I can think of my like beginnings with flow.
So Charis, you had described when you have identified your kind of initial experiences of this in your work. So I'm wondering what are some examples of different experiences that you've had cultivating flow on teams?
Maybe it's helpful to identify the difference in like individual flow when you're like, you know, maybe working on something independently or working through something independently versus collective flow, working on a team, leading different teams, as you're asking about. Because while those experiences do have similarities, I think when we talk about the specifics of cultivating them, it might be it's just helpful to sort of differentiate the two. So when I think about teams and leadership and working with teams and on teams, my experiences of flow really rely heavily on being open to the experiences of my team members and recognizing that the way that each of us like to cultivate flow might be different, and working with that to figure out what is the way that we can most efficiently and also with respect to each other's own process come together to create a unified flow that, you know, is making all of us feel like we can be our most authentic selves, and also highlighting what skills we have and leaving room too to sort of move outside of our maybe designated roles if that's necessary, depending on what our needs are at that time. So yeah, I think really being open to the experiences of my team members, looking to find ways in which we can bring out, you know, the potential of what it is that we have to offer to our collective flow.
I remember in college doing a lot of different types of acting and whatnot. And from the moment I went out on stage until the moment that the curtains went down, I kind of didn't know what was going on. You know your lines, you know where you're supposed to be. But if I had to remember what had occurred, it just wasn't there. It was totally lost. The converse of that is with writing, time can go by, but I remember everything that's going on. So mm-hmm. I don't know if that's sort of like different levels or different depths of flow. But, you know, just to use an example, you said earlier about like teams may need different ways to get into the zone. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very clear to me since I'm working at home and my wife's working at home, she needs a very quiet work kind of environment. And I need sound. Like mm-hmm. I will kind of like my own brain will get the better of me if I don't have things that are going on. Mm-hmm. For a long time with writing, I would usually pull up this album from 1955. It's Glenn Gould playing in the Goldberg Variations, but he played them at a much faster and much more interesting tempo. And for the first 40 minutes of that piece, I would just be kind of writing away and not aware what's going on. And then at some point the music would shift and I would come out of it almost like the same point every time I used it. And I wonder, like, do you have advice, just if we talk about the individual ways of doing this first, mm-hmm. do you have advice in how to fully immerse yourself so that you can get the benefits of a flow state?
Yes. I totally resonate with your experience of sound and music being important to your flow because it can really set the energy. And my partner has ADHD, so he also really needs silence for his work. And the complete absence of music or sound really does influence the way that I work and the way that I create. And I can sort of control what it is that, or the experience that I want to have based on the music that I want to choose. So yeah, music is definitely one way to cultivate a flow state space. And I guess I also would say really kind of just going down the line and looking at what senses or what you can do for your sensory experience to create a headspace that is ideal for flow state. So I also like to light incense, finding one that is grounding if that's what I'm looking for, finding one that maybe is a little bit more uplifting and energizing if that's what I'm looking for. You know, how it is that you set up your space, whether that's your desk or your room, so that it's maybe less cluttered, or maybe you want all of the things that inspire you around you. I mean, if there's something that you like to eat, I know that back in the days when I was studying, I learned that sometimes if you eat something while it is that you're learning something, it's helpful for you to recall that thing later. So maybe there's a snack that you like to eat while it is that you're trying to get into flow state to help recall certain things that could be helpful.
Now that's interesting to me. I've never thought about that. Like if I always did something and I had an orange at the same time, I could like tap back and learn a foreign language more quickly or whatever it is, That's, I love that. I really do. I think that's wonderful. And couching it in sensory perception, I think is really helpful because people know this stuff. You know, some people are like, I'm going to sit and be all snugged up and do my work that way with a blanket on my lap or whatever it is. And other people like me, for example, and Sarah Rhodes, I know as well, are usually up and kind of bouncing around. And so we're more kinetic, I guess, some of our things that we're doing with it. But I find that really fascinating. Speaking for myself, I could get in my own headspace and get kind of block myself from being as productive or as focused as I need to be. And so as we're talking about like how to get into a flow state, I think it's trying to identify what things work for you. And so that you can set the stage to hopefully get to that point kind of, at your own leisure. I know that I studied writing, my undergrad majors in writing and philosophy, and people treated sort of the creative endeavors as like out of their control. They're like, well, I have to, like the moment has to strike me and I will get inspiration. Mm-hmm. Like the very like old trite idea of an artist who is kind of just doing something and they're like, wait a second, I have to go. The muse has spoken to me. And they like run off to their studio and do all these things really frenetically. And I feel like that's not necessarily a false experience overall, but I think that you have to be more comfortable with sort of setting the stage so that you could achieve these things on your terms, not when, you know, when the river flows or whatever. Cheris, do you think that holds water, or am I, you know, barking up the wrong tree to say as many idioms as possible?
I actually feel like that resonates with me because sometimes we do not get to choose the projects that we're working on. We do not get to choose the tasks that we need to accomplish. As much as we don't want to force flow, oftentimes because of, you know, our responsibilities, we have to be doing certain things at certain periods of time. And if we can make that process a little bit more easeful, I think regardless of whether or not we have high skill and the challenge is low, or if, you know, our skills don't necessarily meet the challenge that's ahead, it maybe will create a little bit less of less discomfort for us as we're going through and completing those tasks or projects. But in an ideal situation, you do have control over what it is you're working on. And especially when it, you know, maybe comes to something that's a little bit more creative, as you're mentioning, John, in those situations, when you are confident in the skill that you have and you are excited about the challenge that's ahead, then flow is something that I feel like is, you know, maybe a little bit even easier, is something that will come to you a little bit easier because you are in that sweet spot and the conditions that you've set for yourself are a culmination of what you're doing in that present time, but also your experiences that have led up to that moment, whether that's, you know, the things that you've learned, what you've been inspired by, the insight that you've been gathering, the people that you've been connecting with, all of that has led to the present moment. I'll refer to it as the present moment of flow state, whenever that moment comes for you. So I guess it's a combination of what both of you are describing, and it really is applicable to, I guess it depends on the scenario, right?
Charis, you had mentioned the experience of not forcing flow. And I agree, it depends on the scenario. So in the scenario that you're not forcing flow and you're on a team, what do you do in your experience when you're at a point where you realize that yourself or your team is kind of at a block?
That's a great question. And I think I do a variety of different things. One of the things that I like to do first is communicate and acknowledge that I'm not feeling like we're flowing. just putting it out there, seeing if other people also feel the same way, or if it's maybe an individual that I'm having difficulty with, or our experience that we're finding that there's difficulty. Just communicating and seeing if we're on the same page, at least about that. And if we are, then working together or discussing together what some possible solutions might be. I also think it's important to trust or come back to trust. So trusting that everybody that's on the team is there for a reason, that they were brought onto the team for a purpose, or you hired them for that purpose, depending on, you know, what the situation is. And really remembering why it is that each of us are there. And then in a little bit of a contrast to that, thinking or really accepting that every person is multidimensional, and sometimes it's helpful to see that other people may have the potential to contribute outside of what their roles and responsibilities are. So that, I think, actually comes back to trusting that everybody has their own process for flow. And maybe if somebody has been pinned into a certain role and they've been doing that task repetitively over and over and over again, maybe it might be helpful for that person to step outside of that task or that role or assignment and collaborate with somebody else on the team and do something completely different so that they can bring that insight back into their role when the time comes or when they're ready to or able to. So I think that's a lot of trust, trusting in everybody's potential, trusting in everybody's skill set, and trusting in everybody's ability to find their own flow state or find what works for them, and helping them and helping each other when it is that maybe we can't find what that is for ourselves.
Honestly, it requires me pumping myself up a lot and believing in myself, and that confidence, perceiving that like I can meet this challenge is really hard, and it takes a lot of practice. And to be honest, I think that's where the idea of creating a holding environment, that environment on the team where there's the balance of supports and challenges, where, I mean, that's one of the reasons we have coaching program. We have a coaching program at Ally. We'll be building a mentorship program. I think this is why we have these close relationships, for people to, when I perceive the challenge to be too big for the skills that I have, a close group of people to help me build that confidence in my skills to meet that challenge. How do the different dimensions of your identity become salient in those moments of flow, whether it's individually or on it or cultivating a team?
So something I think that a lot of people can relate to when it comes to identity is racial identity, gender identity, especially in the workplace. And that might feel a little bit different now that many people are working remotely. I identify as a Black woman, and this past year specifically has really been quite a tumultuous but also eye-opening year and an awakening year for many people when it comes to the injustices that Black people face, specifically police brutality, because we all have different identities. And I'll, you know, go back to my identity as a Black woman. That was a very heavy time for me. It was very traumatic to, you know, re-experience that, or experience that collectively with the nation as we sort of unpacked that in all of our different ways. And at that time, the team that I was working with, I was the only person who had that identity, a Black woman on my team. And because of that, my experience of everything that was going on was inherently different from all of the white people on my team. And because I was obviously dealing with the struggles of that trauma sort of being reopened on, you know, a national, very public, widely talked about scale, I had to balance that with, you know, some microaggressions that I was experiencing at work, some disregard for, you know, the conversation, some disagreement with what I felt were the facts, or, you know, I hope you would both agree with me, were the facts of what was actually happening. And that's what I was experiencing with the group of people that I was working with. In those situations, for me personally, it can be very difficult. And I know for a lot of people, it can be very difficult to continue working and continue being or working towards being in the flow. Like, flow what? Like, there's no way possible when you are not feeling emotionally equipped to show up and, you know, be productive, to be efficient, to be contributing in a way that, you know, would be helpful towards the work at hand. So for me, it was important to acknowledge that first for myself. Like, I'm finding it really challenging to work right now. And then to try and see if there was anybody else on my team. And in this case, it was my supervisor. I felt comfortable with speaking to about this and saying, hey, I can't show up right now in the way that I would like to. So is it all right if I just take some time? And if I take some time, I can come back to this work in a way that is, you know, how I want to show up and do my work. But unless we can have a conversation, and unless, you know, the team can have a conversation, and I feel supported in that way, then it is not the best situation for me to be continuing this work at this moment. So having the courage to acknowledge for yourself when you're feeling barriers, and then also to have the courage to identify when there are barriers that are being maybe exasperated by your team members or your working environment, and trying to communicate that as best as you can, and trying to communicate your needs and trying to set boundaries in that moment or in those moments.
Charis, was there anything else that you wanted to share that you haven't already as far as this topic?
As far as this topic goes, I guess I would just hope that everybody who's been listening really has been inspired, and that will find flow in their own pace and in their own time, collectively and individually. If you're interested in learning more about the work that I do or seeing a product that I've created while in the flow state, please feel free to head to www.laid.life. It's been such a pleasure talking with both of you. Thank you for having me.
So, John, I think I can speak for both of us and say that we are both very grateful to have talked to Charis about her experience of flow and cultivating it on teams. So it feels right to segue now into the range of ways to cultivate flow on teams, because she really talked about her unique experience, and there's so many different ways that we can do this on the teams that we are a part of.
We know how to make a flow state achievable, or at least give us the space ourselves. People have a lot of experience, I think, with that, knowing what they need to, like, quote unquote, get the work done. But we're talking about teams. We're talking about this whole season is a group of people working together. How do teams unlock the benefits of flow for themselves as a collective?
So what are the circumstances that create flow on a team?
What can a team put in place to reap the benefits of peak performance?
That's what our whole season, the arc of our season, is identifying the pieces to create flow on a team. Every episode is unlocking a different facet of creating a foundation for flow state or peak performing teams. What it comes down to is that flow state, the flow state is a foundation for peak performance, and creating the context for flow state is everything that we've outlined in our season. Creating that culture of psychological safety supports the experience of flow. And this can be by encouraging team members to ask for help, modeling vulnerability, leading in partnership with the team, but really understanding that this self-consciousness is a barrier to flow state and doing what we can to dissolve self-consciousness on our teams by putting our attention on every single topic that we've outlined in this season. That is how you cultivate flow on teams. Every single episode, if it was helping, like talking about your mistakes, being wrong, modeling vulnerability, collegial inquiry, giving and receiving feedback, understanding that the same psychological safety is not equitably offered to all team members, and then understanding that psychological safety and all these different topics that we've covered are part of the arc of a journey of a team. Like, it doesn't happen overnight. This is something, this is how we build flow on teams. Our season is how to cultivate flow and peak performing teams. And these are the facets of this foundation for high performance, or ultimately the experience of giving teams the tools for self-actualization, the ultimate like personality constellation.
One thing that I feel is a thread through everything that we've talked about and so much of the work that we do outside of this show around team and team building and high performing scrum teams is we talk about this all the time. The scrum master will facilitate the removal of impediments, of blockers, of whatever. And what we're trying to get to with all of this is that we are trying to remove everything that is extraneous, everything that is limiting, all the things that get in the way of teams. So in removing these things for a team, often teams will start with the very smallest of B's, the entry-level issues that one can fix and feel good about themselves. I don't have access to this website. Hey, where's that link to that Google Doc? Whatever those things are, the real sort of like day-to-day, they're almost not blockers. They're just how you work with a team type of stuff. And so what we're trying to build upon is there are these larger looming things that are in the way of a team being high performing. And a lot of that is interpersonal. How does a team work together? How does one teammate affect the rest of their team? Vice versa. How do we remove the anxiety around talking about the things that are, because we have those things that we hold dear. You know what I mean? We have these blockers that we feel comfortable sharing. Even like, yeah, we have mistakes, you know, that we have made or whatever over our time, but we may downplay or try to quickly remedy things on our side. Basically, what I'm trying to get to is if there are boundaries amongst team members, be them knowledge silos, emotional walls, or anxiety like barriers, like I am afraid of you team members, so I will not share any of the things that make me look weak or make me look like less than, then a team is not going to level, like transcend to that point of peak performance. And that's what we're talking about. And that's where I'm super excited, because how great is that? We have a blueprint, we have a platform, we have an idea. It's just many, many steps that are very intricate and take a long time to do. But this is how you want to improve your team. Do these things. All these things that we've talked about are not some new expensive certification or this like, oh, here's this other project management software and the team's now great or whatever it is. The things that we've talked about are achievable on a $0 budget. Yes, you have to spend the time to do it. And yes, you have to practice and research, but we're not talking about investing thousands and thousands of dollars into something to make a team 1% better. It's treating the team like people.
And understanding people and understanding what the context is to create a team that performs at their best. And so using these, exactly what you said, we don't have to spend a lot of money to implement these really foundational concepts of high performing teams. That is not just Sarah Rose and John saying this is what is best. This is based on scholars for decades, leaders who practice leadership in a way that encourages self-actualization, which is essentially this experience of flow, leads to high performance on teams. As you said, it's not something that you can fix with a tool.
Yeah, I think that's a better way to go, is that like, it's not something that you can order off Amazon or no. whatever, or Staples.com.
And it's not something that you can build in a computer. It's something that you pay attention to and you help the other people on the team collectively to create an environment that is conducive to the experience of flow. Something that I wanted to say was like, you and I talked to Charis about her experience of flow. And what I wanted to say is like, the experience of flow is going to be different for everyone. So it's important to note that because the experience is completely subjective, that is why it's important to understand the different barriers, like the variety of barriers to flow, but also what different leaders experience flow. So like understanding the complexities and understanding the wide range of experiences of this particular experience is how we create more of it. Because if we understand the diversity of experiences of people who are of what helps people do their best work, then we can be more conscientious of how we're interacting with our team.
It gives you an idea of what you need to do, and now you have to apply it to the real example of what your team is. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, I'm trying to describe the fact that A, the flow state and vulnerability and all those things will not only be different for other people, but like come out in different ways. But you'll also have to, dig in different methods to uncover these things. And figuring out how to get like a team of like 40-year-old dudes to share will be very, very different than a team of like a wide variety and diverse number of people. So like, sure. So the podcast is like all these great sort of like ideas and concepts, but right. It's only the start. Once you apply them, that's where you start seeing where you're going.
But I do want to say that all of these concepts that we've talked about in the podcast, they're not just made up arbitrary things. This is coming to a point of like data saturation where these experiences are repetitive and they keep happening. It's not like there's so many more we haven't talked about. This is interviewing many different people across many different sectors that all like exhibit these similar things that keep coming up. And that's why they're important. They're not just arbitrary things. These keep happening in their patterns. And so if we can identify these patterns and implement them in our work, then we're that much closer to honoring the different intersections of identity that our team members hold and setting them up for success, whether they're in Scrum, whether they're working in tech or working in education or working in fashion or working in photography, across the board. Because people are people. We are not roles.
So, John, what is your Scrum takeaway as our final episode for season 2?
So, my season 2 Scrum takeaway. When you had originally crafted this concept of doing psychological safety and the research-based strategies and pillars of that. I was really on board. I thought I understood where things fit, and I was excited to discuss it and learn about it more with you and our listeners. What I know now that I didn't know then is that the flow idea of what we talked about today is really like the end possibility, the forever potential that a team can reach to. If you think about it as planting a vegetable garden, you can get the best quality seeds to start. You can bring in great soil that's all rich and loamy and wonderful. You could put the seeds that need full sun in the full sun, the partial shade in the partial shade. You water everything. You put up fencing. You do all this stuff. You're giving the plants the best possible chance of doing what they'll naturally do, which is grow and produce vegetables. We can't control whether a tree falls on the garden and ruins it. That's out of our control. That could happen. We also can't control if we do everything right and then the outcome still isn't what we thought it would be. But we're doing everything that we can to give those plants like the best possible chance of doing what they will naturally do, what is already innate inside of them, which is succeed and grow. So for me, I often thought about flow as like this thing to crack or to figure out. when really what it is it's all of the little choices and decisions, all of the evenings watering the garden and making sure that you have the fencing up and you're checking it out and you clear things off and you pull out the weeds and do all of those things. All those little things are what will give your team the best possible chance of being their best selves. It's setting the stage for their potential to happen. How about you, Sarah Rose, as the original like brain architect of season two, and how we've adapted it over these many months since we first started recording in January 2021, what is your season two Scrum takeaway?
My Scrum takeaway is that I feel like I've found my voice over the course of the season here with you. And I think it takes a lot of practice. And I think that this has been kind of like a microcosm for practicing everything that we preach together, practicing feedback, practicing participation and engagement and bringing it back to our Scrum teams, talking about vulnerability, talking about making mistakes, talking about team autonomy. It's really challenged me to be a better listener. It's challenged me to live what I believe in. And so I think that my Scrum takeaway is exactly aligned with what you shared. This is hard and it is radical and it is exciting. And I think the more that we can create micro environments for growth and conversation, like you and I have been lucky to have here together, the more we can kind of experiment and play with these ideas and bring them back to our teams. So I hope that everyone here can find that person to talk through these ideas, to bounce their ideas off of, and to apply them to the people that they work with. Because it's one thing to be like, to have beliefs in what makes high performing teams. It's another to take the risk to live them out and to help transform the team dynamics of the actual people that we work with on the day-to-day. And so being true to that and living that out is what I've taken away from that, that it's hard and it takes practice and time. And the more patient and active we can be in applying them, the more fulfilling the practice of being an agile leader and practitioner will be.
What I would love to know is that, like, you, January 2021 to you now, do you think that you have a different mindset now than you did 6 months ago?
Yeah, I think that my big takeaway with finding my voice here is how that it transferred into my actual work with my team. Because the more confident I became in these ideas, they weren't just ideas and I could actually do them, especially around team autonomy, especially around leading in partnership with the team and making decisions and not being afraid to take risks. I think I became more comfortable taking risks through this process of talking about it and understanding it more, and then listening back to what we talked about, understanding my own mishaps as far as like giving feedback or my inability to be vulnerable and make mistakes and being wrong, and then like learning how to do that and learning how to talk about my mistakes. Like, this kind of was an incubator for growth for me and actually doing that on my team. So that's what I'm gonna carry forward. It's like really being comfortable with being deeply uncomfortable through these hard facets of what make that experience of happiness and flow possible.
Recorded at Two Tiny Desks in Brooklyn and Raleigh, Two Scrums Up is hosted by Sarah Rose Bellock and John Ragazine. Show logo by Kelsey Lakotos. Season 2 theme music by Jonathan Byerly. Executive producer and North Star, Bridget McNulty. We'd love to learn from your experiences. Please talk to us at Scrums Up on Twitter. Leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice.
People are people. We are not roles. I mean, we could be like loaves of bread, but that's different. Another episode.
You're not roles. I'm a biscuit.